It was easy to lose. It was a strange town, and strange also its people, fishermen and workmen and artisans like any others, but so used to the sorcery that is ever at play on the Isle of the Wise that they seemed half-sorcerers themselves. They talked, as Ged had learned, in riddles, and not one of them would blink to see a boy turn into a fish or a house fly into the air. But knowing it for a schoolboy prank would go on cobbling shoes or cutting up mutton, unconcerned. Coming up past the back door and around through the gardens of the great house, the three boys crossed the clear-running Thwilburn on a wooden bridge and went on northward among woods and pastures. The path climbed and wound. They passed oak groves where shadows lay thick for all the brightness of the sun. There was one grove not far away to the left that Ged could never quite see plainly. The path never reached it, though it always seemed to be about to. He could not even make out what kind of trees they were. Vetch, seeing him gazing, said softly, "That is the imminent grove. We can't come there yet." In the hot sunlit pastures, yellow flowers bloomed. "Sparkweed," said Jasper. "They grow where the wind dropped the ashes of burning Ilion, when Ereth Akbe defended the inward isles from the Fire Lord." He blew on a withered flower head, and the seed shaken loose went up on the wind like sparks of fire in the sun. The path led them up and around the base of a great green hill, round and treeless, the hill that Ged had seen from the ship as they entered the charmed waters of Roke Island. On the hillside, Jasper halted. "At home in Havna, I heard much about Gauntish wizardry and always in praise, so that I've wanted for a long time to see the manner of it. Here now we have a Gauntish one, and we stand on the slopes of Roke Knoll, whose roots go down to the center of the earth. All spells are strong here. Play us a trick, Sparrowhawk. Show us your style." Ged, confused and taken aback, said nothing.
"Later on, Jasper," Vetch said in his plain way. "Let him be a while."
"Well, he has either skill or power, or the doorkeeper wouldn't have let him in. Why shouldn't he show it now as well as later, right, Sparrow? Later, right, Sparrow? Later, show us your style." Ged, confused and taken aback, said nothing.
"Later on, Jasper," Vetch said in his plain way. "Let him be a while."
"Well, he has either skill or power, or the doorkeeper wouldn't have let him in. Why shouldn't he show it now as well as later, right, Sparrowhawk?"
"I have both skill and power," Ged said. "Show me what kind of thing you're talking about."
"Well, illusions, of course. Tricks, games of seeming. Like this." Pointing his finger, Jasper spoke a few strange words, and where he pointed on the hillside, among the green grasses, a little thread of water trickled and grew, and then now a spring gushed out, and the water went running down the hill. Ged put his hand in the stream, and it felt wet, drank of it, and it was cool. Yet for all that, it would quench no thirst, being but illusion. Jasper, with another word, stopped the water, and the grasses waved dry in the sunlight. "And now you, Vetch," he said with his cool smile. Vetch scratched his head and looked glum, but he took up a bit of earth in his hand and began to sing tunelessly over it, molding it with his dark fingers and shaping it, pressing it, stroking it, and suddenly it was a small creature like a bumblebee or furry fly that flew humming off over Roke Knoll and vanished. Ged stood staring crestfallen. What did he know but mere village witchery, spells to call goats, cure warts, move loads, or mend pots?
I do know such tricks as these. And that was enough for Vetch, who was for going on. But Jasper said,
"Why don't you? The sorcery is not a game. We Gauntishmen do not play it for pleasure or praise," Ged answered haughtily.
"Well, what do you play it for? Money?"
"No."
But he could not think of anything more to say that would hide his ignorance and save his pride. Jasper laughed, not ill-humoredly, and went on leading them on around Roke Knoll, and Ged followed, sullen and sore-hearted, knowing he had behaved like a fool, and blaming Jasper for it. That night, as he lay wrapped in his cloak on the mattress in his cold, unlit cell of stone, in the utter silence of the great house of Roke, the strangeness of the place and the thought of all the spells and sorceries that had been worked there began to come over him, heavily. Darkness surrounded him. Dread filled him. He wished he were anywhere else but Roke. But Vetch came to the door, a little bluish ball of ware-light, nodding over his head to light the way, and asked if he could come in and talk a while. He asked Ged about Gaunt, and then spoke fondly of his own home isles of the East Reach, telling how the smoke of village hearth-fires is blown across that quiet sea at evening between the small islands with funny names, Corp, Kop, and Holp, Venway and Vemish, Ifish, Kopish, and Sneg. When he sketched the shapes of those lands on the stones of the floor with his finger to show Ged how they lay, the lines he drew shone dim as if drawn with a stick of silver for a while before they faded. Vetch had been 3 years at the school, and soon would be made sorcerer. He thought no more of performing the lesser arts of magic than a bird thinks of flying. Yet a greater unlearned skill he possessed, which was the art of kindness. And that night, and always from then on, he offered and gave Ged friendship, a sure and open friendship which Ged could not help but return. Yet Vetch was also friendly to Jasper, who had made Ged into a fool that first day on Rokhnol. Ged wouldn't forget this, nor, it seemed, would Jasper, who always spoke to him with a polite voice and a mocking smile. Ged's pride would not be slighted or condescended to. He swore to prove to Jasper and all the rest of them among whom Jasper was something of a leader how great his power really was. Some day. For none of them, for all their clever tricks, had saved a village by wizardry. Of none of them had Ogion written that he would be the greatest wizard of Gaunt. So, bolstering up his pride, he set all his strong will on the work they gave him, the lessons and crafts and histories and skills taught by the gray-cloaked masters of Roke, who were called the Nine. Part of each day he studied with the master chanter, learning the deeds of heroes and the lays of wisdom, beginning with the oldest of all songs, the creation of Ea. Then, with a dozen other lads, he would practice with the master wind key at arts of wind and weather. Whole bright days of spring and early summer they spent out in Roke Bay in light catboats, practicing steering by word and stilling waves and speaking to the world's wind and raising up the mage wind. And these are very intricate skills, and frequently Ged's head got whacked by the swinging boom as the boat jibed under a wind suddenly blowing backwards, or his boat and another collided, though they had the whole bay to navigate in, or all three boys in his boat went swimming unexpectedly as the boat was swamped by a huge unintended wave. And there were quieter expeditions ashore, other days, with the master Herbal, who taught the ways and properties of things that grow. And the master Hand taught sleight and jugglery and the lesser arts of changing. At all these studies Ged was apt, and within a month was bettering lads who had been a year at Roke before him. Especially the tricks of illusion came to him so easily that it seemed he had been born knowing them and needed only to be reminded. The master Hand was a gentle and light-hearted old man who had endless delight in the wit and beauty of the crafts he taught. Ged soon felt no awe of him, but asked him for this spell and that spell, and always the master smiled and showed him what he wanted, One day, having it in mind to put Jasper to shame at last, Ged said to the master Hand in the court of seeming, "Sir, all these charms are much the same, knowing when you know them all, and as soon as the spell-weaving ceases, well, the illusion vanishes. Now, if I make a pebble into a diamond," and he did so with a word and a flick of his wrist, "what must I do to make that diamond remain diamond? How is the changing spell locked and made to last?" The master Hand looked at the jewel that glittered on Ged's palm, bright as the prize of a dragon's hoard. The old master murmured one word, "Talk!" And there lay the pebble, no jewel but a rough gray bit of rock. The master took it and held it out in his own hand. "This is a rock. Talk in the true speech," he said, looking mildly up at Ged now. "A bit of the stone of which Roke Isle is made, a little bit of the dry land on which men live, it is itself. It is part of the world. By the illusion change, you can make it look like a diamond, or a flower, or a fly, or an eye, or a flame." The rock flickered from shape to shape as he named them, and returned to rock. "But that is mere seeming. Illusion fools the beholder's senses. It makes him see and hear and feel that the thing is changed.
But it does not change the thing. To change this rock into a jewel, you must change its true name. And to do that, my son, even to so small a scrap of the world, is to change the world. It can be done. Indeed, it can be done. It is the art of the Master Changer, and you will learn it when you are ready to learn it. But you must not change one thing, one pebble, one grain of sand, until you know what good and evil will follow on that act. The world is in balance, in equilibrium. Wizard's power of changing and of summoning can shake the balance of the world. It is dangerous, that power. It is most perilous. It must follow knowledge and serve need. To light a candle is to cast a shadow.
He looked down at the pebble again.
A rock is a good thing, too, you know,
he said, speaking less gravely.
If the Isles of Earthsea were all made of diamond, we'd lead a hard life here. Enjoy illusions, lad, and let the rocks be rocks.
He smiled, but Ged left dissatisfied. Press a mage for his secrets, and he would always talk, like Ogion, about balance and danger in the dark. But surely a wizard, one who had gone past these childish tricks of illusion to the true arts of summoning and change, was powerful enough to do what he pleased and balance the world as seemed best to him and drive back darkness with his own light. In the corridor he met Jasper, who, since Ged's accomplishments began to be praised about the school, spoke to him in a way that seemed more friendly, but was more scoffing.
You look gloomy, Spinnerhawk, he said now. Did your juggling charms go wrong?
Seeking, as always, to put himself on equal footing with Jasper, Ged answered the question, ignoring its ironic tone.
I'm sick of juggling, sick of these illusion tricks fit only to amuse idle lords and their castles and domains. The only true magic they've taught me yet on Roke is making werelight and some weatherworking. The rest is mere foolery.
Even foolery is dangerous, said Jasper, in the hands of a fool. At that, Ged turned as if he had been slapped and took a step towards Jasper, but the older boy smiled as if he had not intended any insult, nodded his head in his stiff, graceful way, and went on. Standing there with rage in his heart, looking after Jasper, Ged swore to himself to outdo his rival, and not in some mere illusion match, but in a test of power. He would prove himself and humiliate Jasper. He would not let the fellow stand there, looking down at him, graceful, disdainful, hateful. Ged didn't stop to think why Jasper might hate him. He only knew why he hated Jasper. The other apprentices had soon learned they could seldom match themselves against Ged either in sport or in earnest, and they said of him, some in praise and some in spite,
"He's a wizard born. He'll never let you beat him."
Jasper alone neither praised him nor avoided him, but simply looked down at him, smiling slightly, and therefore Jasper stood alone as his rival, who must be put to shame. He didn't see, or would not see, that in this rivalry, which he clung to and fostered as part of his own pride, there was anything of the danger, the darkness, of which the master hand had mildly warned him. When he was not moved by pure rage, he knew very well that he was as yet no match for Jasper, or any of the older boys, and so he kept at his work, and he went on as usual. At the end of summer, the work was slackened somewhat, so there was more time for sport, spellboat races down in the harbor, feats of illusion in the courts of the great house, and in the long evenings in the groves, wild games of hide-and-seek, where hiders and seeker were both invisible, and only voices moved, laughing and calling, among the trees, following and dodging the quick, faint werelights. Then, as autumn came, they set to their tasks afresh, practicing new magic. So Ged's first months at Roke went by fast, full of passions and wonders. In winter it was different. He was sent with 7 other boys across Roke Island to the farthest northmost cape, where stands the Isolate Tower. There by himself lived the Master Namer, who was called by a name that had no meaning in any language, Kurum Karmaruk. No farm or dwelling lay within miles of the tower, and grim it stood above the northern cliffs, gray with the clouds over the seas of winter, endless the lists and ranks and rounds of names that the Namer's 8 pupils must learn. Amongst them in the tower's high room, Kurum Karmaruk sat on a high seat, writing down lists of names that must be learned before the ink faded at midnight, leaving the parchment blank again. It was cold and half dark and always silent there, except for the scratching of the master's pen and the sighing, maybe, of a student who must learn before midnight the name of every cape, point, bay, sound, inlet, channel, harbor, shallows, reef, and rock of the shores of Lassau, a little island of the Pelnish Sea. If the student complained, the master might say nothing but lengthen the list, or he might say, "He who would be sea master must know the true name of every drop of water in the sea." Get sighed sometimes. But he didn't complain. He saw that in this dusty and fathomless matter of learning the true name of every place, thing, and being, the power he wanted lay like a jewel at the bottom of a dry well. For magic consists in this, the true naming of a thing. So Kurum Karmaruk had said to them once, their first night in the tower, and he never repeated it. But Ged did not forget his words. "Many a mage of great power," he had said, "has spent his whole life to find out the name of one single thing, one single lost or hidden name, and still the lists are not finished, nor will they be till world's end. Listen, and you will see why. In the world under the sun, and in the other world that has no sun, there is much that has nothing to do with men and men's speech, and there are powers beyond our power. But magic, true magic, is worked only by those beings who speak the Hardic tongue of Earthsea, or the old speech from which it grew. That is the language dragons speak, and the language Sigoi spoke who made the islands of the world, and the language of our lays and songs, spells, enchantments, and invocations. Its words lie hidden and changed among our Hardic words. We call the Foman waves Sukayen, and that word is made from 2 words of the old speech, Suk, feather, and Inayen, the sea. Feather of the sea is foam. But you cannot charm the foam calling it Sukayen. You must use its own true name in the old speech, which is Issa. Any witch knows a few of these words in the old speech, and a mage knows many. But there are many more, and some have been lost over the ages, and some have been hidden, and some are known only to dragons, and to the old powers of earth, and some are known to no living creature, and no man could learn them all, for there is no end to that language. And here is the reason. The sea's name is Inayen, well and good, but what we call the inmost sea has its own name also in the old speech. And since no thing can have 2 true names, Inayen can mean only all the sea except the inmost sea. And of course it does not mean even that, for there are seas and bays and straits beyond counting that bear names of their own. So if some mage seamaster were mad enough to try to lay a spell of storm or calm over all the ocean, his spell must say not only that word, Inayen, but the name of every stretch and bit and part of the sea through all the archipelago and all the outer reaches and beyond to where names cease. Thus, that which gives us the power to work magic sets the limits of that power. A mage can control only what is near him, what he can name exactly and wholly. And this is well. If it were not so, the wickedness of the powerful or the folly of the wise would long ago have sought to change what cannot be changed, and equilibrium would fail. The unbalanced sea would overwhelm the islands where we perilously dwell. And in the old silence, all voices and all names would be lost. Ged thought long on these words, and they went deep in his understanding. Yet the majesty of the task could not make the work of that long year in the tower less hard and dry. And at the end of the year, Kurram Karmaruk said to him, "You have made a good beginning, but no more. Wizards speak truth," and it was true that all the mastery of names that Ged had toiled to win that year was the mere start of what he must go on learning all his life. He was let go from the Isolate Tower sooner than those who had come with him, for he had learned quicker. But that was all the praise he got. He walked south across the island alone in the early winter, along townless empty roads. As night came on, it rained, and he said no charm to keep the rain off him, for the weather of Rok was in the hands of the Master Wind Key, and might not be tampered with. He took shelter under a great pendic tree, and lying there wrapped in his cloak, he thought of his old master, Ogion, who might still be on his autumn wanderings over the heights of Gaunt, sleeping out with leafless branches for a roof and falling rain for house walls. And that made Ged smile, for he found the thought of Ogion always a comfort to him, and he fell asleep with a peaceful heart, there, in the cold darkness full of the whisper of water. And at dawn, waking, he lifted his head. The rain had ceased. He saw, sheltered in the folds of his cloak, a little animal curled up asleep, which had crept there for warmth. He wondered, seeing it, for it was a rare strange beast, an otak. These creatures are found only on four southern isles of the archipelago, Rok, Ensmer, Poddy, and Wathort. They are small and sleek, with broad faces and fur dark brown or brindle, and great bright eyes. Their teeth are cruel and their temper fierce, so they are not made pets of. They have no call or cry or any voice. Ged stroked this one, and it woke and yawned, showing a small brown tongue and white teeth, but it was not afraid. "Otak," he said. And then, remembering the thousand names of beasts he had learned in the tower, he called it by its true name in the old speech. "Hoeg, do you want to come with me?" The otak sat itself down on his open hand and began to wash its fur. He put it up on his shoulder in the folds of his hood, and there it rode. Sometimes during the day it jumped down and darted off into the woods, but it always came back to him once with a wood mouse it had caught. He laughed and told it to eat the mouse, for he was fasting, this night being the festival of sun return. So he came in the wet dusk past Rok Knoll and saw bright werelights playing in the rain over the roofs of the great house, and he entered there and was welcomed by his masters and companions in the firelit hall. And it was like a homecoming to Ged, who had no home to which he could ever return. He was happy to see so many faces he knew, and happiest to see Vetch come forward to greet him with a wide smile on his dark face. He had missed his friend this year more than he knew. Vetch had been made sorcerer this fall, and was apprentice no more. But that set no barrier between them. They fell to talking at once, and it seemed to Ged that he said more to Vetch in that first hour than he had said during the whole long year at the Isolate Tower. The otak still rode his shoulder, nestling in the fold of his hood as they sat at dinner at long tables set up for the festival in the hearth hall. And Vetch marveled at the little creature, and once put up his hand to stroke it, but the otak snapped its sharp teeth at him, and he laughed.
"They say, Sverohawk, that a man favored by a wild beast is a man to whom the old powers of stone and spring will speak in human voice."
"They say gauntish wizards often keep familiars," said Jasper, who sat on the other side of Vetch. "Our lord Nemele has his raven, and songs say the red mage of Ark led a wild boar on a gold chain. But I never heard of any sorcerer keeping a rat in his hood." At that they all laughed, and Ged laughed with them. It was a merry night, and he was joyful to be there in the warmth and merriment, keeping festival with his companions. But, like all Jasper ever said to him, the jest set his teeth on edge. That night the Lord of O was a guest of the school, himself a sorcerer of renown. He'd been a pupil of the Archmage and returned sometimes to Rok for the winter festival or the long dance in summer, And with him was his lady, slender and young, bright as new copper, her black hair crowned with opals. It was seldom that any woman sat in the halls of the great house, and some of the old masters looked at her sidelong, disapproving, but the young men looked at her with all their eyes.
"For such a one," said Vetch to Ged, "I could work vast enchantments."
He sighed and laughed.
"She's only a woman," Ged replied.
"The Princess Alfarin was only a woman," said Vetch, "and for her sake all Enlad was laid waste, and the hero mage of Havnor died, and the island Solea sank beneath the sea."
"Old tales," said Ged.
But then he too began to look at the Lady of O, wondering if, indeed, this was such mortal beauty as the old tales told of. The master chanter had sung the deed of the young king, and altogether had sung the winter carol. Now, when there was a little pause before they all rose from the tables, Jasper got up and went to the table nearest the hearth, where the archmage and the guests and master sat, and he spoke to the Lady of O. Jasper was no longer a boy, but a young man, tall and comely, with his cloak clasped at the neck with silver, for he also had been made sorcerer this year, and the silver clasp was the token of it. The lady smiled at what he said, and the opals shone in her black hair, radiant. And then, the master's nodding benign consent, Jasper worked an illusion charm for her. A white tree he made spring up from the stone floor. Its branches touched the high roof beams of the hall, and on every twig of every branch a golden apple shone, each a sun, for it was the year tree. A bird flew among the branches, suddenly all white with a tail like a fall of snow, and the golden apples dimming turned to seeds, each one a drop of crystal. And these, falling from the tree with a sound like rain, all at once there came a sweet fragrance, while the tree, swaying, put forth leaves of rosy fire and white flowers like stars. And so the illusion faded. The Lady of O cried out with pleasure and bent her shining head to the young sorcerer in praise of his mastery.
"Come with us, live with us in Otokni. Can he not come, my lord?" she asked, childlike, of her stern husband.
But Jasper said only, "When I have learned skills worthy of my master's here, and worthy of your praise, my lady, then I will gladly come and serve you ever gladly." So he pleased all there, except Ged. Ged joined his voice to the praises, but not his heart.
"I could have done better," he said to himself, in bitter envy. And all the joy of the evening was darkened for him after that.
Chapter 4. The Loosing of the Shadow. That spring Ged saw little of either Vetch or Jasper, for they being sorcerers studied now with the master patterner in the secrecy of the imminent grove, where no prentice might set foot. Ged stayed in the great house, working with the masters at all those skills practiced by sorcerers, those who work magic but carry no staff, wind-bringing, weather-working, finding and binding, in the arts of spell-smiths and spell-rights, tellers, chanters, heal-alls and herbalists. And at night, alone in his sleeping cell, a little ball of werelight burning above the book in place of lamp or candle, he studied the further runes, and the runes of Ea, which are used in the great spells. And all these crafts came easy to him, and it was rumored among the students that this master or that had said that the Gondish lad was the quickest student that had ever been at Roke, and tales grew up concerning the Otak, which was said to be a disguised spirit who whispered wisdom in Ged's ear, and it was even said that the Archmage's raven had hailed Ged at his arrival as Archmage-to-be. Whether or not they believed such stories, and whether or not they liked Ged, most of his companions admired him and were eager to follow him when the rare wild mood came over him, and he joined them to lead their games on the lengthening evenings of spring. But, for the most part, he was all work and pride and temper, and held himself apart. And among them all, Vetch being absent, he had no friend, and never knew he wanted one. He was 15, very young to learn any of the high arts of wizard or mage, those who carried the staff, but he was so quick to learn all the arts of illusion
that the master changer, himself a young man, soon began to teach him, apart from the others, and to tell him about the true spells of shaping. He explained how, if a thing is really to be changed into another thing, it must be renamed for as long as the spell lasts. And he told how this affects the names and natures of things surrounding the transformed thing. He spoke of the perils of changing, above all when the wizard transforms his own shape, and thus is liable to be caught in his own spell. And little by little, drawn on by the boy's sureness of understanding, the young master began to do more than merely tell him of these mysteries. He taught him first one and then another of the great spells of change, and he gave him the Book of Shaping to study. And this he did without knowledge of the Archmage, and unwisely. Yet he meant no harm. Ged worked also with the master summoner now, but that master was a stern man, aged and hardened by the deep and somber wizardry he taught. He dealt with no illusion, only true magic, the summoning of such energies as light and heat, and the force that draws the magnet, and those forces men perceive as weight, form, color, sound, real powers drawn from the immense fathomless energies of the universe, which no man's spells or uses could exhaust or unbalance. The weather workers and sea masters calling upon wind and water were crafts already known to his pupils, but it was he who showed them why the true wizard uses such spells only at need, since to summon up such earthly forces is to change the earth of which they are a part. "Rain on Roke may be drought in Oskill," he said, "and a calm in the east reach may be a storm and ruin in the west, unless you know what you are about. As for the calling of real things and living people and the raising up of spirits of the dead and the invocations of the unseen, those spells, which are the height of the summoner's art and the mage's power, those, he scarcely spoke of to them. Once or twice Ged tried to lead him to talk a little of such mysteries, but the master was silent, looking at him long and grimly, till Ged grew uneasy and said no more. Sometimes, indeed, he was uneasy working even such lesser spells as the summoner taught him. There were certain runes on certain pages of the lore book that seemed familiar to him, though he didn't remember in what book he had ever seen them before. There were certain phrases that must be said in spells of summoning that he didn't like to say. They made him think, for an instant, of shadows in a dark room, of a shut door and shadows reaching out to him from the corner by the door. And hastily he put such thoughts or memories aside and went on. These moments of fear and darkness, he said to himself, they were the shadows merely of his ignorance. And the more he learned, the less he'd have to fear, until finally, in his full power as wizard, he need fear nothing in the world, nothing at all. In the second month of that summer, all the school gathered again at the great house to celebrate the moon's night and the long dance, which that year fell together as one festival of two nights, which happened but once in 52 years. All the first night, the shortest night of full moon of the year, flutes played out in the fields, and the narrow streets of Thwill were full of drums and torches, and the sound of singing went out over the moonlit waters of Roke Bay. As the sun rose next morning, the chanters of Roke began to sing the long Deed of Erith Akbi, which tells how the white towers of Havnor were built, and of Erith Akbi's journeys from the old island Ea, through all the archipelago and the reaches, until at last, in the uttermost west reach, on the edge of the open sea, he met the dragon Orm, and his bones in shattered armor lie among the dragon's bones on the shore of lonely Celador. But his sword set atop the highest tower of Havnor still burns red in the sunset above the inmost sea. And when the chant was finished, the long dance began. Townsfolk and masters and students and farmers, all together men and women, danced in the warm dust and dusk down all the roads of Roke to the sea beaches, to the beat of drums and drone of pipes and flutes. Straight out into the sea they danced under the moon one night past full, and the music was lost in the breaker's sound. As the east grew light, they came back up the beaches and the roads, the drums silent, and only the flutes playing soft and shrill. So it was done on every island of the archipelago that night. One dance, one music, binding together the sea-divided lands.
And when the long dance was over, most people slept the day away and gathered again at evening to eat and drink, and there was a group of young fellows, prentices and sorcerers, who had brought their supper out from the refectory to hold private feast in a courtyard of the great house. Vetch, Jasper, and Ged were there, and six or seven others, and some young lads released briefly from the Isolate Tower, for this festival had brought even Kurum Karmaruk out. They were all eating and laughing and playing such tricks out of pure frolic as might be the marvel of a king's court. And one boy had lighted the court with 100 stars of werelight, colored like jewels, that swung in a slow, netted procession between them and the real stars. And a pair of boys were playing bowls with balls of green flame and bowling pins that leaped and hopped away as the ball came near. And all the while, Vetch sat cross-legged, eating roast chicken up in midair. And one of the younger boys tried to pull him down to earth, but Vetch merely drifted up a little higher out of reach and sat calmly, smiling on the air. And now and then he tossed away a chicken bone, which turned to an owl and flew hooting among the netted starlights. Ged shot breadcrumb arrows after the owls and brought them down, and when they touched the ground, there they lay, bone and crumb, all illusion gone. Ged also tried to join Vetch up in the middle of the air, but lacking the key of the spell, he had to flap his arms to keep aloft, and they were all laughing at his flights and flaps and bumps. And he kept up his foolishness for the laughter's sake, laughing with them, for after those two long nights of dance and moonlight and music and majory, he was in a fey and wild mood, ready for whatever might come. And he came lightly down on his feet just beside Jasper at last, and Jasper, who never laughed aloud, moved away, saying, "The sparrowhawk that can't fly." "Is Jasper a precious stone?" Ged returned, grinning. "O jewel among sorcerers, O gem of Havnor, sparkle for us." The lad that had set the lights dancing sent one down to dance and glitter about Jasper's head, not quite as cool as usual. Frowning, Jasper brushed the light away and snuffed it out with one gesture. "I am sick of boys and noise and foolishness," he said.
"You're getting middle-aged, lad," Vetch remarked from above.
"If silence and gloom is what you want," put in one of the younger boys, "you could always try the tower."
Ged said to him, "What is it you want, then, Jasper?"
"I want the company of my equals," Jasper said. "Come on, Vetch, leave the prentices to their toys."
Ged turned to face Jasper.
"What do sorcerers have that prentices lack?"
His voice was quiet, but all the other boys suddenly felt still, for in his tone, as in Jasper's, the spite between them now sounded plain and clear as steel coming out of a sheath.
"Power," Jasper said.
"Well, I'll match your power act for act."
"You challenge me?"
"I challenge you." Vetch had dropped to the ground, and now he came between them, grim of face.
"Duels and sorcery are forbidden to us, and well you know it. Let this cease."
Both Ged and Jasper stood silent, for it was true they knew the law of Roke, and they also knew that Vetch was moved by love and themselves by hate. Yet their anger was balked, not cooled. Presently, moving a little aside, as if to be heard by Vetch alone, Jasper spoke with his cool smile. "I think you'd better remind your goat-herd friend again of the law that protects him. He looks sulky. I wonder, did he really think I'd accept a challenge from him, a fellow who smells of goats, a prentice who doesn't know the first change?"
"Jasper," said Ged, "what do you know of what I know?"
For an instant, with no words spoken that any heard, Ged vanished from their sight, and where he had stood a great falcon hovered, opening its hooked beak to scream. For one instant, and then Ged stood again in the flickering torchlight, his dark gaze on Jasper. Jasper had taken a step backward, in astonishment. But now he shrugged and said one word,
"Illusion."
The others muttered. Vetch said,
"That was not illusion. It was true change. And enough. Jasper, listen. Enough to prove that he sneaked a look in the Book of Shaping behind the master's back. What then?
Go on, goatherd. I'd like this trap you're building for yourself. The more you try to prove yourself my equal, the more you show yourself for what you are."
At that, Vetch turned from Jasper and said very softly to Ged,
"Sparrowhawk, will you be a man and drop this now? Come with me."
Ged looked at his friend and smiled, but all he said was, "Keep Hoeg for me a little while, will you?" He put into Vetch's hands the little Otek, which as usual had been riding on his shoulder. It had never let any but Ged touch it, but it came to Vetch now. and climbing up his arm, cowered on his shoulder, its great bright eyes always on its master.
"Now," Ged said to Jasper, quietly as before, "what are you going to do to prove yourself my superior, Jasper?"
"I don't have to do anything, Goatherd, yet I will. I will give you a chance, an opportunity. Envy eats you like a worm in an apple. Let's let out the worm. Once, by Roke Knoll, you boasted that gauntish wizards don't play games. Come to Roke Knoll now and show us what it is they do instead. And afterward, maybe I will show you a little sorcery."
"Yes, I should like to see that," Ged answered.
The younger boys, used to seeing his black temper break out at the least hint of slight or insult, watched him in wonder at his coolness now. Vetch watched him not in wonder, but with growing fear. He tried to intervene again, but Jasper said, "Come, keep out of this, Vetch. Well, what will you do with the chance I give you, goat herd? Will you show us an illusion, a fireball, a charm to cure goats with the mange?"
"What would you like me to do, Jasper?"
The older lad shrugged. "Summon up a spirit from the dead, for all I care."
"I will."
"You will not." Jasper looked straight at him, rage suddenly flaming over his disdain. "You will not. You cannot. You brag and brag."
"By my name, I will do it."
They all stood utterly motionless for a moment. Breaking away from Vetch, who would have held him back by main force, Ged strode out of the courtyard, not looking back. The dancing werelights overhead died out, sinking down. Jasper hesitated a second, and then followed after Ged, and the rest came straggling behind, in silence, curious, and afraid. The slopes of Roke Knoll went up dark into the darkness of summer night before moonrise. The presence of that hill where many wonders had been worked was heavy, like a weight in the air about them. As they came out of the hillside, they thought of how the roots of it were deep, deeper than the sea, reaching down even to the old, blind, secret fires at the world's core. They stopped on the east slope. The stars hung over the black grass above them on the hill's crest. No wind blew. Ged went a few paces up the slope, away from the others, and turning, said in a clear voice, "Jasper, whose spirit shall I call?"
"Call whom you like. None will listen to you."
Jasper's voice shook a little with anger, perhaps. Ged answered him softly, mockingly, "Are you afraid?" He did not even listen for Jasper's reply, if he made one. He no longer cared about Jasper. Now that they stood on Roke Knoll, hate and rage were gone, replaced by utter certainty. He need envy no one. He knew that his power this night on this dark enchanted ground was greater than it had ever been, filling him till he trembled with a sense of strength barely kept in check. He knew now that Jasper was far beneath him, had been sent perhaps only to bring him here tonight. No rival, but a mere servant of Ged's destiny. Under his feet he felt the hill roots going down and down into the dark, and over his head he saw the dry, far fires of the stars. Between, all things were his to order, to command. He stood at the center of the world. "Don't be afraid," he said, smiling. "I'll call a woman spirit. You need not fear a woman. Elfarin I will call, the fair lady of the deed of Enlad. She died 1,000 years ago. Her bones lie afar under the sea of Ea, and maybe there never was such a woman." "Well, do years and distances matter to the dead? Do the songs lie?" Ged said this with the same gentle mockery, and then, saying, "Watch the air between my hands," he turned away from the others and stood still. In a great, slow gesture, he stretched out his arms, the gesture of welcome that opens an invocation. He began to speak. He had read the runes of this spell of summoning in Ogion's book 2 years and more ago, and never since had seen them. In darkness he had read them then, and now in this darkness it was as if he read them again, on the page open before him in the night. But now he understood what he read, speaking it aloud word after word, and he saw the markings of how the spell must be woven, with the sound of the voice and the motion of body and hand. And the other boys stood watching, not speaking, not moving, unless they shivered a little, for the great spell was beginning to work. Ged's voice was soft, still, but changed with a deep singing in it, and the words he spoke were not known to them. He fell silent. Suddenly the wind rose, roaring in the grass. Ged dropped to his knees and called out aloud, and then he fell forward, as if to embrace earth with his outstretched arms, and when he rose he held something dark in his straining hands and arms, something so heavy that he shook with effort getting to his feet. And the hot wind whined in the black tossing grasses on the hill, and if the stars shone now, none saw them. The words of the enchantment hissed and mumbled on Ged's lips, and then he cried out aloud and clearly, "Elfaron!" Again he cried the name, "Elfaron!" The shapeless mass of darkness he had lifted split apart. It sundered, and a pale spindle of light gleamed between his opened arms, a faint oval reaching from the ground up to the height of his raised hands. In the oval of light for a moment there moved a form, a human shape, a tall woman looking back over her shoulder. Ah, her face was beautiful and sorrowful and full of fear. Only for a moment did the spirit glimmer there, and then the sallow oval between Ged's arms grew bright. It widened and spread, a rent in the darkness of the earth and night, a ripping open of the fabric of the world. Through it blazed a terrible brightness, and through that bright, misshapen breach clambered something like a clot of black shadow, quick and hideous, and it leaped straight out at Ged's face. Staggering back under the weight of the thing, Ged gave a short, hoarse scream. The little Otak, watching from Vetch's shoulder, the animal that had no voice, screamed aloud also and leaped as if to attack. Ged fell, struggling and writhing, while the bright rip in the world's darkness above him widened and stretched. The boys that watched fled, and Jasper bent down to the ground, hiding his eyes from the terrible light. Vetch alone ran forward to his friend, so only he saw the lump of shadow that clung to Ged, tearing at his flesh. It was like a black beast the size of a young child, though it seemed to swell and shrink, and it had no head or face, only the four taloned paws with which it gripped and tore. Vetch sobbed with horror, yet he put out his hands to try to pull the thing away from Ged. Before he touched it, he was bound still, unable to move. The intolerable brightness faded, and slowly the torn edges of the world closed together. Nearby, a voice was speaking as softly as a tree whispers or a fountain plays. Starlight began to shine again, and the grasses of the hillside were whitened with the light of the moon just rising. The night was healed. Restored and steady lay the balance of light and dark. The shadow beast was gone. Ged lay sprawled on his back, his arms flung out as if they yet kept the wide gesture of welcome and invocation. His face was blackened with blood, and there were great black stains on his shirt. The little Otak cowered by his shoulder, quivering, and above him stood an old man whose cloak glimmered pale in the moonrise, the Archmage Nemerly. The end of Nemerly's staff hovered, silvery, above Ged's breast. Once gently it touched him over the heart, and once on the lips, while Nemerly whispered. Ged stirred, and his lips parted, gasping for breath. Then the old Archmage lifted the staff and set it to earth and leaned heavily on it with bowed head, as if he had scarcely strength to stand. Vetch found himself free to move. Looking around, he saw that already others were there, the masters, summoner, and changer. An act of great wizardry is not worked without arousing such men, and they had ways of coming very swiftly when need called, though none had been so swift as the Archmage. They now sent for help, and some who came went with the Archmage, while others, Vetch among them, carried Ged to the chambers of the Master Herbal. All night long the summoner stayed on Roke Knoll, keeping watch. Nothing stirred there on the hillside where the stuff of the world had been torn open. No shadow came crawling through moonlight, seeking the rent through which it might clamber back into its own domain. It had fled from Nemerly, and from the mighty spell walls that surround and protect Roke Island. But it was in the world now, in the world somewhere it hid. If Ged had died that night, it might have tried to find the doorway he had opened and follow him into Death's realm, or slip back into whatever place it had come from. For this, The summoner waited on Roque Knoll, but Ged lived. They had laid him a bed in the healing chamber, and the master herbal tended the wounds he had on his face and throat and shoulder. They were deep, ragged, and evil wounds. The black blood in them would not stanch, welling out even under the charms and the cobweb-wrapped periot leaves laid upon them. Ged lay blind and dumb in fever, like a stick in a slow fire, and there was no spell to cool what burned him. And not far away, in the unroofed court where the fountain played, the archmage lay also unmoving, but cold, very, very cold. Only his eyes lived, watching the fall of moonlit water and the stir of moonlit leaves. And those with him said no spells and worked no healing. Quietly, they spoke among themselves from time to time, and then turned again to watch their lord. He lay still, hawk nose and high forehead and white hair bleached by moonlight, all to the color of bone. To check the ungoverned spell and drive off the shadow from Ged, Nemerly had spent all his power, and with it his bodily strength was gone. He lay dying. But the death of a great mage who has many times in his life walked on the dry, steep hillsides of death's kingdom is a strange matter, for the dying man goes not blindly, but surely, knowing the way. And when Nemerly looked up through the leaves of the tree, those with him did not know if he watched the stars of summer fading in the daybreak, or those other stars which never set above the hills that see no dawn. The raven of Oskil that had been his pet for 30 years was gone. No one had seen where it went. "It flies before him," the master patterner said, as they kept vigil. The day came warm and clear. The great house and the streets of Thwil were hushed. No voice was raised, until along towards noon iron bells spoke out aloud in the chanter's tower, harshly tolling. On the next day, the 9 masters of Roque gathered in a place somewhere under the dark trees of the imminent grove. Even there they set 9 walls of silence about them, that no person or power might speak to them or hear them, as they chose from amongst the mages of all Earthsea him who would be the new archmage. Genscher of Wei was chosen. A ship was sent forth at once across the inmost sea to Wei Island to bring the archmage back to Ro. The master Windkey stood in the stern and raised up the mage wind into the sail, and quickly the ship departed and was gone. Of these events, Ged knew nothing. For 4 weeks of that hot summer he lay blind and deaf and mute, though at times he moaned and cried out like an animal. At last, as the patient crafts of the master herbal worked their healing, his wounds began to close, and the fever left him. Little by little he seemed to hear again, though he never spoke. And on a clear day of autumn the master herbal opened the shutters of the room where Ged lay. Since the darkness of that night on Roque Knoll, he had known only darkness. Now he saw daylight and the sun shining. He hid his scarred face in his hands, and he wept. Still, when winter came, he could speak only with a stammering tongue, and the master herbal kept him there in the healing chambers, trying to lead his body and mind gradually back to strength. It was early spring when at last the master released him, sending him first to offer his fealty to the archmage Genscher. For he had not been able to join all the others of the school in this duty when Genscher came to Roque. None of his companions had been allowed to visit him in the months of his sickness, and now, as he passed, some of them asked one another, "Who is that?" He had been light and lithe and strong. Now, lamed by pain, he went hesitantly and did not raise his face, the left side of which was white with scars. He avoided those who knew him and those who did not, and made his way straight to the court of the fountain. There, where once he had awaited Nemerly, Genscher awaited him. Like the old archmage, the new one was cloaked in white, but like most men of Wei in the East Reach, Genscher was black-skinned, and his look was black under thick brows. Ged knelt and offered him fealty and obedience. Genscher was silent a while.
"I know what you did," he said at last, "but not what you are. I cannot accept your fealty."
Ged stood up and set his hand on the trunk of the young tree beside the fountain to steady himself. He was still very slow to find words.
"Am I to leave, Roke, my lord?"
"Do you want to leave, Roke?"
"No."
"What do you want?"
"To stay, to learn, to undo the evil."
"Nemerly himself could not do that. No, I would not let you go from Roke. Nothing protects you but the power of the masters here, and the defenses laid upon this island that keep the creatures of evil away. If you left now, the thing you loosed would find you at once and enter into you and possess you. You would be no man, but a Gebeth, a puppet doing the will of that evil shadow which you raised up into the sunlight. You must stay here until you gain strength and wisdom enough to defend yourself from it, if ever you do. Even now it waits for you. Assuredly it waits for you. Have you seen it since that night?"
"In dreams, Lord."
After a while, Ged went on, speaking with pain and shame.
"Lord Genscher, I do not know what it was, the thing that came out of the spell and cleaved to me."
"Nor do I know. It has no name. You have great power inborn in you, and you use that power wrongly to work a spell over which you had no control, not knowing how that spell affects the balance of light and dark, life and death, good and evil. And you were moved to do this by pride and by hate. Is it any wonder the result was ruin? You summoned a spirit from the dead, but with it came one of the powers of unlife. Uncalled, it came from a place where there are no names. Evil, it wills to work evil through you. The power you had to call it gives it power over you. You are connected. It is the shadow of your arrogance, the shadow of your ignorance, the shadow you cast. Has a shadow a name?"
Ged stood sick and haggard. He said at last, "Better I had died."
"Who are you to judge that? You for whom Nemerly gave his life? You are safe here. You will live here and go on with your training. They tell me you were clever." "Yeah, well, go on and do your work. Do it well. It is all you can do."
So Genscher ended, and was suddenly gone, as is the way of mages. The fountain leaped in the sunlight, and Ged watched it a while and listened to its voice, thinking of Nemerly. And once in that court, he had felt himself to be a word spoken by the sunlight. Now, the darkness also had spoken, a word that could not be unsaid. He left the court, going to his old room in the south tower, which they had kept empty for him, and he stayed there alone. When the gong called to supper, he went, but he would hardly speak to the other lads at the long table or raise his face to them, even those who greeted him most gently. So after a day or two, they all left him alone. To be alone was his desire, for he feared the evil he might do or say unwittingly. Neither Vetch nor Jasper was there, and he did not ask about them. The boys he had led and lorded over were all ahead of him now, because of the months he had lost. And that spring and summer he studied with lads younger than himself. Nor did he shine among them, for the words of any spell, even the simplest illusion charm, came halting from his tongue, and his hands faltered at their craft. In autumn he was to go once again to the Isola Tower to study with the master Namer. This task, which he had once dreaded, now pleased him, for silence was what he sought, and long learning where no spells were wrought, and where that power which he knew was still in him would never be called upon to act. The night before he left for the tower, a visitor came to his room, one wearing a brown traveling cloak and carrying a staff of oak shod with iron. Ged stood up at sight of the wizard's staff.
"Sparrowhawk!"
At the sound of the voice, Ged raised his eyes. It was Vetch standing there, solid and foursquare as ever, his black, blunt face older, but his smile unchanged. On his shoulder crouched a little beast, brindle-furred and bright-eyed.
He stayed with me while you were sick, and now I'm sorry to part with him, and sorrier to part with you, Sparrowhawk. But I'm going home. Here, Hoag, go to your true master.
Vetch patted the Otak and set it on the floor. It went and sat on Ged's pallet, and began to wash its fur with a dry brown tongue like a little leaf. Vetch laughed, but Ged could not smile. He bent to hide his face, stroking the Otak.
"I thought you wouldn't come to me, Vetch," he said. He didn't mean any reproach, but Vetch answered,
"I couldn't come to you. The Master Herbal forbade me, and since winter I've been with the Master in the Grove, locked up myself. I was not free until I earned my staff. Listen, when you two are free, come to the East Reach. I will be waiting for you. There's good cheer in the little towns there, and wizards are well received."
"Free,"
Ged muttered and shrugged a little, trying to smile. Vetch looked at him, not quite as he had used to look, with no less love but more wizardry, perhaps, and he said gently,
"You won't stay bound on Roke forever."
"Well, I have thought perhaps I may come to work with the Master in the Tower, to be one of those who seek among the books and the stars for lost names, and so do no more harm, if not much good."
Well, maybe. I am no seer, but I see before you not rooms and books, but far seas, and the fire of dragons, and the towers of cities, and all such things a hawk sees when he flies far and high.
And behind me? What do you see behind me?
Ged asked, and stood up as he spoke, so that the ware-light that burned overhead between them sent his shadow back against the wall and floor. Then he turned his face aside and said, stammering,
But tell me where you will go, and what you will do.
I will go home, to see my brothers and the sister you have heard me speak of. I left her a little child, and soon she'll be having her naming. It's strange to think of, and so I'll find me a job of wizardry somewhere among the Little Isles. Oh, I would stay and talk with you, but I can't. My ship goes out tonight, and the tide has turned already. Sparrowhawk, if ever your way lies east, come to me. And if ever you need me, send for me. Call on me by my name, Istariol.
At that, Ged lifted his scarred face, meeting his friend's eyes.
"Istario," he said. "My name is Ged."
And then, quietly, they bade each other farewell, and Vetch turned and went down the stone hallway and left Roke. Ged stood a while, like one who has received great news and must enlarge his spirit to receive it. It was a great gift that Vetch had given him, the knowledge of his true name. No one knows a man's true name but himself and his namer. He may choose at length to tell it to his brother or his wife or his friend, yet even those few will never use it where any third person may hear it. In front of other people, they will, like other people, call him by his ewe's name, his nickname, such a name as Sparrowhawk and Vetch and Ogion, which means fir cone. If plain men hide their true name from all but a few they love and trust utterly, so much more must wizardly men, being more dangerous and more endangered. Who knows a man's name holds that man's life in his keeping. Thus, to Ged, who had lost faith in himself, Vetch had given that gift only a friend can give, the proof of unshaken, unshakable trust. Ged sat down on his pallet and let the globe of ware-light die, giving off, as it faded, a faint whiff of marsh gas. He petted the Otak, which stretched comfortably, and went to sleep on his knee as if it had never slept anywhere else, and the great house was silent. It came to Ged's mind that this was the eve of his own passage, the day on which Ogion had given him his name. 4 years were gone since then. He remembered the coldness of the mountain spring through which he had walked naked and unnamed. and he fell to thinking of other bright pools in the River Ar, where he had used to swim, and of Ten Alder's village under the great slanting forests of the mountain, of the shadows of morning across the dusty village street, the fire leaping under bellows blast in the smith's smelting pit on a winter afternoon, the witch's dark, fragrant hut where the air was heavy with smoke and wreathing spells. He had not thought of these things for a long time. Now they came back to him on this night. On this night he was 17 years old. All the years and places of his brief, broken life came within mind's reach and made a whole again. He knew once more, at last, after this long, bitter, wasted time, who he was and where he was. But where he must go in the years to come, that he could not see. And he feared to see it. Next morning, he set out across the island, the Otak riding on his shoulder, as it had used to. This time it took him 3 days, not two, to walk to the isolate tower, and he was bone-weary when he came in sight of the tower above the spitting, hissing seas of the northern cape. Inside it was dark as he remembered, and cold as he remembered, and Kurum Karmoruk sat on his high seat writing down lists of names. He glanced at Ged and said without welcome, as if Ged had never been away, "Go to bed. Tired is stupid. Tomorrow you may open the book of the undertakings of the Makers, learning the names therein." At winter's end he returned to the Great House. He was made sorcerer then, and the Archmage Genscher accepted at that time his fealty. Thenceforth he studied the high arts and enchantments, passing beyond arts of illusion to the works of real magery, learning what he must know to earn his wizard's staff. The trouble he had had in speaking spells wore off over the months, and skill returned into his hands. Yet he was never so quick to learn as he had been, having learned a long, hard lesson from fear. Yet no ill portents or encounters followed on his working even of the great spells of making and shaping, which are most perilous, and he came to wonder at times if the shadow he had loosed might have grown weak or fled somehow out of the world, for it came no more into his dreams. But in his heart he knew such hope was folly. From the masters and from ancient lore books Ged learned what he could about such beings as this shadow he had loosed. Little was there to learn. No such creature was described or spoken of directly. There were at best hints here and there in the old books of things that might be like the shadow beast. It was not a ghost of human man, nor was it a creature of the old powers of earth, and yet it seemed it might have some link with these. In The Matter of the Dragons, which Ged read very closely, there was a tale of an ancient dragon lord who had come under the sway of one of the old powers, a speaking stone that lay in a far northern land. "At the stone's command," said the book, "he did speak to raise up a dead spirit out of the realm of the dead, but his wizardry being bent awry by the stone's will, there came with the dead spirit also a thing not summoned, which did devour him out from within, and in his shape walked, destroying men." But the book did not say what the thing was, nor did it tell the end of the tale. And the masters did not know where such a shadow might come from. "From unlife," the Archmage had said. "From the wrong side of the world," said the Master Changer. And the Master Summoner said, "I do not know." The Summoner had come often to sit with Ged in his illness. He was grim and grave as ever, but Ged knew now his compassion and loved him well. "I do not know. I know of the thing only this, that only a great power could have summoned up such a thing, and perhaps only one power, only one voice, your voice. But what in turn that means, I do not know. But you will find out. You must find out, or die, and worse than die," he spoke softly and his eyes were somber as he looked at Ged, "you thought as a boy that a mage is one who can do anything. And so I thought once. So did we all, and the truth is that as a man's real power grows, and his knowledge widens, ever the way he can follow grows narrower, until at last he chooses nothing, but does only and wholly what he must do. The Archmage sent Ged, after his 18th birthday, to work with the Master Patterner. What is learned in the Immanent Grove is not much talked about elsewhere. It is said that no spells are worked there, and yet the place itself is an enchantment. Sometimes the trees of that grove are seen, and sometimes they are not seen, and they are not always in the same place and part of Roke Island. It is said that the trees of the grove themselves are wise. It is said that the Master Patterner learns his supreme magery there within the grove, and if ever the trees should die, so shall his wisdom die, and in those days the waters will rise and drown the islands of Earth Sea, which Sigoy raised from the deeps in the time before myth, all the lands where men and dragons dwell. But all this is hearsay, and wizards will not speak of it. And so the months went by, and at last, on a day of spring, Ged returned to the great house, and he had no idea what would be asked of him next. At the door that gives on the path across the fields to Roke Knoll, an old man met him, waiting for him in the doorway. At first Ged did not know him, and then, putting his mind to it, recalled him as the one who had let him into the school on the day of his coming, 5 years ago. The old man smiled, greeting him by name, and asked, "Do you know who I am?" Now, Ged had thought before of how it was always said the nine masters of Roke, although he knew only eight. Windkey, Hand, Herbal, Chanter, Changer, Summoner, Namer, Patterner. It seemed that people spoke of the Archmage as the ninth, yet when a new Archmage was chosen, nine masters met to choose him. "I think you are the Master Doorkeeper," said Ged.
"I am. Ged, you won entrance to Roke by saying your name. Now you may win your freedom of it by saying mine."
So said the old man, smiling, and waited. Ged stood dumb. He knew a thousand ways and crafts and means for finding out names of things, and of men, of course. Such craft was a part of everything he had learned at Roke, for without it there could be little useful magic done. But to find out the name of a mage and master was another matter. A mage's name is better hidden than a herring in the sea, better guarded than a dragon's den. A prying charm will be met with a stronger charm. Subtle devices will fail, devious inquiries will be deviously thwarted, and force will be turned ruinously back upon itself.
"You keep a narrow door, master," said Ged at last. "I must sit out in the fields here, I think, and fast till I grow thin enough to slip through."
"As long as you like," said the doorkeeper.
So Ged went off a little way and sat down under an alder on the banks of the Thwilburn, letting his otak run down to play in the stream and hunt the muddy banks for creek crabs. And the sun went down late and bright, for spring was well along. Lights of lantern and warelight gleamed in the windows of the great house, and down the hill the streets of Thwiltown filled with darkness. Owls hooted over the roofs, and bats flitted in the dusk air above the stream, and still Ged sat thinking how he might, by force, ruse, or sorcery, learn the doorkeeper's name. The more he pondered, the less he saw. Among all the arts of witchcraft he had learned in these 5 years on Roke, any one that would serve to wrest such a secret from such a mage. He lay down in the field and slept under the stars with the otak nestling in his pocket, and after the sun was up he went, still fasting, to the door of the house and knocked. The doorkeeper opened.
"Master," said Ged, I cannot take your name from you, not being strong enough, and I cannot trick your name from you, not being wise enough. So I am content to stay here and learn or serve whatever you will, unless by chance you will answer a question I have."
Ask it.
What is your name?
The doorkeeper smiled and said his name, and Ged, repeating it, entered for the last time into that house. When he left it again, he wore a heavy dark blue cloak, the gift of the township of Low Torning, whereto he was bound, for they wanted a wizard there. He carried also a staff of his own height, carved of yew wood, bronze shod. The doorkeeper bade him farewell, opening the back door of the great house for him, the door of horn and ivory, and he went.